Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. My name's Margarita, and I'm joined by the lovely Dan.
Thank you very much. Today, we have The Enlightenment and Its Alternatives, featuring Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, and Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, Steven Pinker. This took place in 2023 at II Live, the virtual monthly event holding debates and talks for those to see around the world. So, Margarita, could you tell us a bit more about this debate?
Yeah, so in this debate, John Mearsheimer and Steven Pinker questioned whether the Enlightenment, known for its ideas of rationality and reason, has in fact been successful in bringing about moral progress. And they also questioned if there were any viable alternatives to the Enlightenment vision.
Sounds interesting. But remember, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Now it's time to welcome our host, Sophie Scott Brown, to Philosophy for Our Times. We hope you enjoy listening.
Hello, and welcome to The Enlightenment and Its Alternatives. The Enlightenment advocated reason, science, democracy, and universal human rights as a grounding for human morality and social organization. In the quarter millennium since, to what extent have these ideals been realized? Has the Enlightenment, in fact, been successful in bringing about moral progress? Or are there viable alternatives to the Enlightenment vision? Joining us to discuss this fascinating topic tonight are two speakers who barely need introduction. Nevertheless, I will give you one all the same. First of all, we have Steven Pinker. Steven is the John Stone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University and one of the most prominent public intellectuals of our time. Steven is the author of Rationality, What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, Why It Matters, and also Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Also joining us is John Mearsheimer. John is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, and is considered to be one of the most influential international relations theorists of his generation. He is the author of How States Think, The Rationality of Foreign Policy, and The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams and International Realities. Each speaker is going to have around about 5 or so minutes to lay out their pitch for us. And the provocation that I'll be asking both of them to respond to is, we associate values such as universal liberty and justice with the Enlightenment. Do they harm or hinder the world, or do they help the world? Now, Stephen, I'm going to turn to you first. Enlightenment values, what do you think?
Thank you. So what are Enlightenment values or Enlightenment ideals? In a nutshell, I would say it's the ideal that we should use reason to improve human flourishing. What do I mean by reason? Well, open deliberation, science, history, evaluation of ideas. And the fruits of reason have been implemented in certain institutions, in particular, liberal democracy, regulated markets, and international institutions. That would be the Enlightenment ideal in a nutshell. What do I mean by flourishing? Well, I mean things that each of us wants for ourselves and by extension can't deny to others: life, health, sustenance, prosperity, peace, freedom, safety, knowledge, leisure, happiness. Now, the ideals of the Enlightenment are not to be confused with the idea that we should venerate some great men of the 18th century. They were just guys. It's the ideas that count. And certainly not that we should exalt the West, because the West has always been ambivalent in its commitment to Enlightenment ideals. There are plenty of counter-Enlightenment themes that have had great influence in the West. What are the alternatives? Well, of course, there's religion, that we should obey God's commandments and holy scriptures. There's romantic nationalism and authoritarianism, that nations embodied in strong leaders should strive for historic greatness. There's various forms of zero-sum struggle that subjugated victim groups must overcome, aggressive groups, and their reactionary ideologies that we should reject modernity and return to a golden age. Has the Enlightenment worked? Well, we've had a quarter of a millennium to find out. We can compare this what has happened in the last 250 years for the various dimensions of human flourishing. So let's go to the data. Life expectancy worldwide for millennia hovered around 30 years of age. Today, it is more than 70 years worldwide and more than 80 in developed countries. Child mortality, historically anywhere from a third to a fifth of children died before the age of five. Now it is 0.3%, about 4% worldwide. Famine was one of the horsemen of the apocalypse and could strike anywhere when there was a crop failure. Today, famines have been decimated and occur only in war zones and in some autocracies. Extreme poverty, 200 years ago, about 90% of the world lived in what we would today call extreme poverty. Today, it's less than 9%. Great power war, the 800-pound gorillas of the day, several hundred years ago, were pretty much always at war. Today, they are never at war. The last great power war pitted the U.S. against China and Korea 70 years ago. Democracy, there used to be a handful of democracies. Now a slight majority of countries are democratic, even with the democratic recession of the last decade or so. All the great states and empires used to mete out justice by gruesome forms of torture, like crucifixion, breaking on the wheel, disembowelment. But during the Enlightenment, there was a wave of abolitions of judicial torture, including the United States' prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. Slavery used to be ubiquitous. All the great states and empires practiced it. Starting in the Enlightenment, there was a trickle of abolitions that grew into a flood. Today, slavery is not legal anywhere on earth. Homicide in Europe used to be about 35 per 100,000 per year. In Europe now, it's about 1 per 100,000 per year. Other parts of the world are more dangerous, but they've also seen declines. Used to be that about 10% of the world was literate a couple of hundred years ago. Now it's closer to 90%, especially if you look at people under the age of 25. And it used to be that about less than a fifth of the world had a basic education. Today, it's almost four-fifths. Also today, countries that are guided by Enlightenment ideals, and I would roughly identify those with liberal democracies, are, according to our best data, the healthiest countries, the safest in terms of safety from violent crime and war, the cleanest in terms of measures of environmental quality, the happiest, and they are the most popular destination of people who vote with their feet. People want to go to liberal democracies if they possibly have the opportunity. Well, I'll leave the case of the Enlightenment at that for now and look forward to hear what John has to say.
I want to make it clear that I'm not arguing that there has been no progress since 1680, which is when the Enlightenment started. And I'm not arguing that the Enlightenment didn't contribute to some of that progress, some of which Steve described in his presentation. My argument has to do with the question of whether or not the Enlightenment has led to moral and political progress. And when we talk about moral and political progress, we're talking about first principles. We're talking about questions regarding the good life. And the question is, has the Enlightenment created a situation where there is large-scale consensus, almost overwhelming consensus, on questions about first principles, on questions about the good life? That would be evidence, in my opinion, of moral progress. And I think that's an argument that Steve makes in his work, that we have achieved both moral and political progress as a result of the Enlightenment. And I, of course, disagree with that. And I want to make three points. First of all, the core argument is that unfettered reason leads individuals to come to agreement about questions regarding the good life. In other words, unfettered reason, or what Steve calls the escalator of reason, leads us toward truth. It leads us towards agreement on first principles, and therefore we make moral and political progress. My argument is that unfettered reason involving lots of individuals does not lead to agreement. In fact, it leads to significant disagreement. People cannot agree about first principles. They cannot agree about questions regarding the political goods. They cannot agree about questions regarding justice, and therefore you're not making moral and political progress. And in fact, this is why politics is so important. If you look at Steve's work, politics is not very important because he believes that in the end, you're getting large scale agreement on these central questions. My argument is you don't get central agreement, you get disagreement. And sometimes that disagreement is so fervent that people end up killing each other. And this is why politics is so important in my story. My second point is that people who focus on the Enlightenment focus on the individualism. Radical individualism is associated with the Enlightenment. My view is that human beings are social animals to begin with, who carve out room for their individualism. But because they're social animals to begin with, human beings belong to tribes. Today we call them nations. Human beings are very tribal. And when you're in a tribe or you're in a nation, your identity is inextricably bound up with that nation. You have interests, you have ways of looking at the world. You have views about what is just and what is not just that are bound up with being a member of that nation. So in the end, what that means is that sense that individuals are parts of nations and nations disagree on first principles makes it even harder to reach agreement on what are moral and political answers to the big questions in life. Then finally, there's the matter of international relations. I actually believe that people who focus on the Enlightenment argue that by using reason, we can come up with what Kant called perpetual peace. I don't believe that at all. I believe that because the international system is anarchic, which is to say that there's no higher authority in that system, that if a state uses reason to think about how to survive in that system, and of course survival has to be its principal goal, that state and other states are going to engage in security competition, and that security competition is sometimes going to lead to war. So in an anarchic system like the international system, basically you have a situation where reason leads not to peace, but it leads to competition and sometimes deadly conflict. So it's for those three reasons that I disagree with the argument that the Enlightenment leads to consensus, to some sort of truth about political and moral factors. Thank you.
So, Steve, if I could return to you and just picking up on John's arguments here, is politics slightly missing from the account you've given us so far? I mean, it looked incredibly rosy and very, very optimistic even, but is there sort of some political context that have been missing? For example, are liberal democracies attractive because actually, historically speaking, they were colonial powers and the countries that are not so attractive were put into very difficult economic situations by successful and quite aggressive states, which are now liberal democracies? Is there any scope for agreed frameworks for reasoning and shared decision making that could lead to the kind of accumulated collective progress that Enlightenment seems to feel is necessary?
Oh, absolutely. It's called democracy. The Enlightenment thinkers were obsessed with how you can have a political organization that is not vested in, say, a absolute monarch with divinely granted powers. And the ideals such as free speech and democracy were absolutely predicated on the fact that people do disagree. There is absolutely no presumption that everyone has the same values or the same beliefs. That's why you need democracy. That is, given that people aren't going to agree, how are we going to govern ourselves? On the other hand, it's important not to exaggerate how much disagreement there is compared to, say, 250 or 500 years ago, compared to, say, the era of the wars of religion. The world's nations did sign the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it has informed dozens, perhaps scores of constitutions. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is pretty detailed, and you've got every country signing on to it, often, you know, sometimes in the breach, sometimes hypocritically. But the a lot of the ideals actually command pretty wide assent, but not a universal assent. There are still, of course, religious fanatics. There are still authoritarian despots. There are still glory-mad expansionist leaders. But the ideals of the Enlightenment are not a guarantee that everyone will come around, but they are arguments about which way we ought to be heading. In terms of individualism, another point that John mentioned, among the individual needs, benefits is belonging to a group, belonging to a family, having friends, belonging to institutions, belonging to organizations. There's nothing about recognizing the right of individuals that contradicts the idea that we like to belong to groups as long as they don't coerce us, as long as we can leave those groups. And that includes nations. I mean, it is true that people belong to nations, but not everyone in a nation agrees with everyone else in the nation. That's why we have arguments and political parties and contested elections and people who come and go and leave and disagree with their leaders unless they're threatened with jail for doing so. It is exactly a precept of the Enlightenment in its commitment to democracy that people within a nation actually disagree with each other, and that the fact that the nation might have a religion, an ideology, doesn't mean that it is right for every last individual to be coerced into conforming to it. And we know historically and from current events, people don't. There's lots of dissent in every country as long as it's allowed. In terms of whether the competition for security means that we will perpetually be at war, I mean, that predicts that war, the rate of war should be at pretty much a constant level throughout history. And it's not. It's gone way down, especially since the end of the Second World War. And the rates go up and down, I think, depending in good part on nations' commitments to Enlightenment ideals versus thirst for glory and grandeur and preeminence. That's a variable that we see goes up and down and varies from country to country. Countries that used to be at each other's throats for centuries or millennia have decided that they'd be better off cooperating. So that can happen too. I don't think that the nature of the international system pins us to a constant level of war at every period in history.
Steve, I think if you read your book carefully and you read Better Angels, your other important book from my point of view, carefully, it's very clear that you talk about truth and allowing truth to prevail. That's language from your book. Right.
So well, approaching the truth, yes. We don't know what it is, but we try to get there.
Okay. But I would just say that how do you get moral and political progress if you don't get truth? If you have a situation where individuals can't agree on first principles and they battle it out, I mean, look at the United States today, the red versus blue divide, and we could point to all sorts of other examples like this. How do you make progress, right? It just seems to me that progress is inextricably bound up with the concept of truth. Now, when you talk about it, you point to progress as the coming of liberalism. And in fact, you say that there is this escalator of reason out there. And you say explicitly that we're getting smarter. And you say explicitly that getting smarter means you become liberal, right? So it looks like in your story to me that the truth is becoming a liberal, establishing a liberal society. And I think that's a hard argument to make. I like liberalism very much. I'm thrilled. I'm ecstatic about the fact that I was born into liberal America, right? So I'm not against liberalism. But as you well know, there are a lot of people on the planet who don't like liberalism at all. There are many opponents of liberalism. And if you look at what's been happening on the planet with regard to liberalism, liberal democracies have been decreasing since 2006. So it doesn't look like such a rosy picture. But my more important point is, do you really want to identify progress with liberalism and argue that anybody who opposes liberalism is therefore in the wrong?
Yeah, so I would identify progress really with human flourishing. Now, some of those ideals, like freedom, do overlap with liberalism, and I'd be prepared to argue that they're better values. But some of them, like living longer, kids not dying, mothers not dying in childbirth, people not getting stabbed to death in muggings, people not getting thrown in jail because they disagree with the king, I think those are, I get some of those are liberal values. Equality of women, you know, there are a lot of people who don't agree with the ideal of equality of women, to put it mildly. But I would argue that there's some that I think are universally agreed upon, such as health, longevity, sustenance. There's some that are where there are holdouts, but there's still a significant trend, such as equality of women. The countries that deny women the vote have been dwindling, so the only one left is the Vatican. The direction in terms of laws that discriminate against women is that they are falling off the books. The countries that have laws that criminalize homosexuality are liberalizing that. So actually, I think there is actually a trend toward liberal values, and I think they are most defensible. That is, if you have an open discussion, an open argument, if people from different backgrounds have to come together and decide what they agree upon, which they're motivated to do in order to have a global community where they're not at each other's throats, then they do tend to settle on certain universal values. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the most obvious example. If someone were to say that the first universal principle is we accept Jesus Christ as our Savior, well, you know, a lot of people are going to fall by the wayside. But if it's that people should have an education, that people shouldn't be jailed because of their opinions, then it's, you know, much harder for someone to argue against them. And historically, that's why I think liberal values in general actually have increased. You're right that democracy has stalled in the last 15 years or so, but it's still way higher than it was, you know, 20 years ago, to say nothing 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
But there's not a consensus there. That's the point. But I just want to go a step further on this. One of the points that's clear from reading your book is that you believe that if you go to the academia, the world that you and I operate in, there are huge numbers of people who you think are at odds with your way of looking at the world. These are people who are not using reason for good ends. If the academy, where you would expect people to privilege reason, is filled with individuals who think in ways that you think are contrary to producing progress, how can you argue that we're moving in a positive direction? And it's not only that, the academy that you point to, you also point to a large number of great thinkers, people who enjoy great esteem in the academy, people like Foucault, people like Fanon, people like Nietzsche, as people who are hindering progress, people who are getting in the way. You also argue that anybody who believes in these isms, these ideologies, or, you know, is asking for trouble. It's also, ideologies are also a hindrance to progress on the moral and political front. Given this panoply of forces that are acting in ways that are contrary to your argument, how can you argue we're making progress?
Yes, so, you know, I'd be the first to say that there are a lot of pathologies in a number of our institutions, not least the one that employs the two of us. And, you know, in that regard, your institution is doing a whole lot better than mine. University of Chicago comes close to the top in rankings for freedom of expression, and Harvard comes close to the bottom. I'm working to try to change that. But the most general answer to your question is, a belief that there has been progress is not a belief that everything gets better everywhere for everyone all the time. That wouldn't be progress. That would be a miracle. And I don't believe in miracles. Progress is incremental. It has setbacks. It has to, because it's not a force of the universe. You're right that there was a conception of progress as some mystical force that carries us ever upward. That's not what I'm advocating at all. Quite the contrary, most of the forces of the universe are kind of trying to grind us down, and we push back with deliberation, with reason, with argument, with evidence. And there's no guarantee of success. Sometimes brute force wins. Sometimes people are under the spell of delusions or malignant ideologies. The idea that the normative argument of what we ought to do and the descriptive argument of where we are separate. It could be that there are certain things we ought to do and not enough people are doing them, and they should change, and we should try to persuade them to change. But yeah, things could go wrong. And in some places, things have gone wrong. I think on average, we're better off now than we were 100 years ago or 200 years ago, to say nothing of 2,000 years ago. But yeah, stuff happens. Things go wrong.
Progress is not always the getting it right and accumulating that rightness. Maybe it's the understanding more about how you might go about getting it right. John, is that a convincing argument for you?
No, but my point, Sophie, is that for an academic like you, an academic like Steve, and an academic like me, we should realize that deliberation and reason in different individuals leads to different conclusions about what is the political or moral good. At all of our universities, what you find are huge numbers of people who are very smart, who have truly impressive critical faculties, who can't agree on much of anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. There's certainly plenty of disagreement, there's no question. But how many, and again, by the way, I want to distinguish academia, which is an institution, which, you know, as we both agree, has some pathologies. But that's not the same as the larger, say, Republic of Letters, the intellectual sphere, which also includes, you know, think tanks and publications and newspapers and independent bloggers and so on. But even within academia, there's not a whole lot of people who would give a defense of a return to traditional gender roles, that women should be kept out of the workplace, or that homosexuality should be criminalized, or that war is heroic and manly and thrilling and spiritual, and that humanity will become decrepit if we ever have peace. Arguments that people used to have that are pretty much obsolete, that we should have racial segregation, that we should look to the Bible as a source of history as opposed to science. There's plenty that we agree on, and there's certainly a pretty big froth of disagreement on top, but there is intellectual progress in the sense that there are crazy superstitions that were pretty, and monstrous beliefs that people by and large have abandoned, at least in arenas where you can make arguments about them.
So John, are you confident that things aren't going to slip backwards again, or do you see new myths forming to replace the old ones?
Well, it's not so much myths. I think that reason can lead individuals to come up with smart views that the world works in one way, and lead other individuals to come up with smart views that the world works in other ways. In international relations, the world I operate in, I have a particular theory of realism. I argue that realism best explains how the world works. Steve is a very smart guy, and he uses his critical faculties to think about how the world works, and he comes up with a fundamentally different view of international politics than I do. It's what I would call a liberal view. And that is my basic point, that smart individuals, right, can use their critical faculties to come up with different views. And when you have different views, how do you have progress? The fact that Steve and I disagree about international progress, about international relations, makes me wonder whether it makes sense to talk about us achieving progress in understanding how the world works.
If we take, say, the history of science as our guide, we find that at any given time there are controversies. There are people who, you know, yell at each other. There are people who hate each other's guts. There are people who each thinks the other one is stupid. But you know, sometimes enough years pass, enough empirical tests are done, enough arguments are aired, and we find that one of them was right, one of them was wrong. Rewind the clock 80 years and scientists disagreed over whether heredity was carried in protein or DNA. And the DNA guys won and the protein guys lost. It may be that even in the realm of international relations, if John and I say, and you know, John and his various colleagues and me and my various colleagues, even tried to, let's say we had an adversarial collaboration and we tried to make concrete predictions about what would happen in the next, you know, year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, time passes, and maybe one of us is wrong, one of them is right. And in fact, even in the areas in which retrospectively we made predictions, I think there are some cases in which each of us has probably made predictions that are embarrassed by the course of events. Did Germany try to acquire nuclear weapons? Did the era of one nation state invading another to try to acquire territory go into abeyance? You know, I think each of us, did the rate of war increase or decrease after the transition from bipolarity to unipolarity? probably if we rewound the clock, probably both of us would have some embarrassments and some successes, but done proactively, maybe our descendants in 25 years will say, oh, liberalism was a good idea, but it was falsified, or vice versa. Maybe realism seemed like a good idea at the time, but historical events have shown it to be wrong. So at any given time, of course, there will be controversy over the controversial issues, but that doesn't mean that controversies are never resolved.
I think, Steve, when you're talking about the moral and political realm, as opposed to, let's say, the medical realm, right? In the moral and political realm, it is almost impossible to reach meaningful consensus on a widespread scale. There's always going to be significant disagreement. This is my basic point.
How about the desirability of a Marxist-Leninist command and control economy and political system? I think including in academia, there's not complete consensus, but I think that reasonable people would say, yeah, we tried that experiment, didn't work.
I think there's no question that ideas come and go, right? And I think that the example of what's happened with Marxism is basically correct. It had its heyday, and it's no longer a very influential ideology. But the point is, it's not that the new ideologies that have appeared and the old ideologies that have hung on have fought with each other, and we've had some sort of dialectical process that has led to a consensus. And my argument is you need a consensus to get progress. And what we're talking about here, the dependent variable, so to speak, is moral and political progress.
Let's pick back up with this idea of the individual, for example. The individual, John, Steve's individual is not this isolated entity. They are a multi-social being. They have not abandoned their social belonging. They're members of many different sorts of groups, and that's, in some sense, what is individual about them. It's just that no one predominates. There are distinctions and divisions even within nations. Nations are not unified concepts. What do you think to that?
Look, I think when you think about human nature, Sophie, you have to ask yourself a basic question. Do you think that we are first and foremost individuals who form social contracts? This is what liberalism is all about. Or do you think that we are first and foremost social individuals who carve out room for our individualism? Almost all Enlightenment thinkers, and I think this is true of Steve, start with the individual. The focus is on the individual, and it's individual reason that really matters. My argument is that we are first and foremost social animals. We're born and socialized into tribes, what we now call nations. And folks like Steve believe that those tribes get in the way of rational thinking. They get in the way of coming to some sort of consensus which equals progress. And this is quoting from Steve. He says, "Political tribalism is the most insidious form of irrationality today." Political tribalism, which you equate with the nation in your work. I'm arguing that there is some truth in that, that nationalism, identity with a nation, the fact that we live in a world of nation states, makes it difficult to reach progress. But if you do believe that we are social animals, that causes all sorts of problems for Steve's argument.
One of the challenges of the Enlightenment is, how do you have large-scale social groupings like nations without coercion of forcing people to sacrifice their interests for a majority or even the most powerful? So and that's why we have liberal democracy. That's why we have freedom of speech. That's why nations have decreasingly identified themselves with some single religion or ethnic group, and have become defined, admittedly retrospectively, by something closer to a social contract. Now, it's not historically true that people sat down together and they hashed out the details for a country, but in terms of rationalizing what are the defensible arrangements for a country, I think it's really good the United States is not a Christian nation. It's good that it doesn't define itself as a white nation or even an Anglo nation, that the other nations that people want to live in are nations that are multicultural, that accept difference, that recognize rights of individuals. Among the rights of individuals are to affiliate voluntarily with groups like religions or clubs or whatever they want, but to have the violence that is monopolized by a state identified with a particular ethnic group, I would argue is a terrible idea, because you're never going to have only the members of one bloodline, of one kindred, of one ethnic group, of one religion sharing a territory. People move around, they have feet. Every territory has people from multiple backgrounds, multiple tribes, multiple cultures. It's really a bad idea if the wielder of the enormous force called a government serves the interests of only one bloodline. I think that is an ancient idea. I think we naturally regress to it. I do believe in human nature. I, of all people, I wrote a book called In Defense of Human Nature called The Blank Slate. But I do think that there's some features of human nature, like greed, like lust, like exploitation, like sadism, like revenge, that we ought to develop institutions to control, and tribalism being one of them. Now, why do I think that tribalism leads to irrationality? Well, I'll be very concrete. You present the same policy prescription. Here's a way to do healthcare. And you say this came from the American Democratic Party. The Democrats favor it, the Republicans oppose it. They take the exact same policy. You say, oh, this came from the Republican Party. Now the Republicans favor it, the Democrats oppose it. Now that's irrational. Likewise, you give people math problems, results of a study. If it favors a liberal policy prescription, the liberals will overlook mathematical errors and vice versa. And conversely, if it supports a conservative position. If you give people a logical syllogism and it's consistent with a left-wing position, the leftists will think it's logically impeccable. The right-wingers will disagree. And conversely, if the syllogism leads to a different conclusion. So tribalism patently leads to irrationality, classically defined, that is making math errors and logic errors and logical inconsistencies. And I think it's an incoherent basis for a modern nation state, because nations are all heterogeneous.
Look, I'm happy that I live in a country that is not a Christian country. And I'm happy to live in a multicultural country. I do not want to live in a white country, period. Okay, so you and I agree on that. But the point I would make to you, Steve, is that there are a lot of our fellow Americans who disagree with you and me on that. And furthermore, once you go outside the boundaries of the United States, as you well know, there are lots of countries who think that, you know, multi-ethnic societies is a bad thing, and they regret that they have X's or Y's living inside their borders, and they'd like to push them out or suppress them or so forth and so on. There's not a lot of harmony in those multi-ethnic states. And again, that is what underpins my argument that we have not made a lot of progress over time.
Yeah. Well, there's part of the argument I'm making is normative. That is, it is true that there are a lot of societies that try to be monolithic ethnostates. I argue that that's, and many of us would argue that that's not viable, that they will be torn by strife because they will have significant minorities, and that it's bad to expel them, it's bad to repress them, it's bad to deny them rights. So there's that normative argument. Then there's the argument of, you know, kind of, are those of us who believe this, you know, are we winning? And it's certainly not true that we have convinced the entire world. But there's a separate question of what has been the trend? That is, do you have more societies that recognize minority rights, that say extend the franchise to every religion and every ethnic group? Do you have more societies that criminalize a religion? It's not unanimous. It hasn't swept over the entire globe. But I think, in fact, that has been the trend. Over a span of about 60 years, if you plot the number of nations that have various kinds of apartheid or Jim Crow-like discrimination laws on the books, and the proportion that have various kind of affirmative action policies on their books, the curves have crossed. So more countries today actually put a thumb on the scale in favor of their minorities than legally oppress them. Now, it's still not 100% and 0%, and maybe it shouldn't be, but the empirical fact of how many people are convinced that this is the way a society ought to be run is also separate from how ought a society to be run.
Can we talk about liberalism in the sense that actually it's the political idea, the political concept that's best of that does best at handling the sort of differences that we're talking about, and that actually that's why it's so successful. John, what do you think about that?
I agree completely with that. I think that liberalism is predicated on the assumption that individuals cannot agree about first principles. They cannot agree about questions of the good life. And sometimes those disagreements are so intense that people kill each other. So liberalism deals with that fundamental set of problems, right, by creating civil society, by giving people room to live life the way they see fit. Liberalism also privileges individual rights. It says that you, Sophie, have the right to live this way. I, John, have the right to live this way. And we can live life the way we see fit in civil society. Furthermore, liberalism preaches tolerance. And the reason that liberalism preaches tolerance is because, again, people can't agree on first principles. So if you and Steve have fundamentally different views on religion, and there's a danger that one of you will kill the other because of that disagreement, what you want to do is inculcate you with tolerance, teach you to tolerate each other's different views. And then finally, liberalism privileges the creation of a state to make sure that no single person is in a position to kill another person. But that's what liberalism is all about. It's all about dealing with the fact that there is no consensus. There is no consensus on political and moral questions of the first order.
So is progress, Steve, really, when it comes down to it, actually just acknowledging that no consensus is really possible? We just have to learn to live and manage these differences as best we can. Is that actually an alternative account of progress?
Well, certainly you could get that argument, but my point is just quickly, Steve, I think that's not Steve's definition of progress.
Yeah, I think that it's a component, but it's not the definition of progress. I would define progress as enhancements in human flourishing. And I gave a list of health, safety, sustenance, the things that people want for themselves, basically, when given a choice. But the fact of disagreement stemming from the undeniable fact that humans are different, both individually and culturally, but nonetheless have to come to working arrangements despite that disagreement. The fact that despite the disagreement, some factual opinions are better than others. We don't know them a priori because we're not the truth has not been vouchsafed to us from some deity. It hasn't been stated in the scriptures. We've got to blunder along and discover what the truth is. Likewise, we've got to experiment, blunder, to find the best arrangements for living together. And some of them work better than others in terms of the criteria of enhancing human flourishing. People will disagree at any given time. But I think it's an exaggeration to say that no one agrees with anyone else on any first principle. If you look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals, every country, 193 countries, agreed on which way the world ought to go. That is, poverty should be reduced, safety should be increased, access to clean water should be increased, child death should be decreased, infectious disease should be decreased. There's an awful lot of agreement. And then we can reframe other arguments as what will get us to the state that many of us agree on. Now, again, not everyone. There are some people who have messianic visions that the world is not going to be a great place until everyone obeys all of God's commandments. And if kids die, it doesn't matter one way or another. But to the extent that people do agree that babies dying is bad, and by and large they do, then that changes the argument from disagreements over first principles to disagreements over means to the end. And even then, if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, there's an awful lot of agreement over things that the world's nations should get together and do.
I just don't think, Steve, there's any disagreement on issues of safety, health, and sustenance. That's not the issue. We're talking about moral and political principles here. We're talking about first principles, what comprises the good life. That's where the real disagreement
is. Wait, I guess I'm not seeing that. Isn't fewer children dying a moral principle? That is, we ought to have fewer children dying. It's good to have fewer people dying. It's evil to let kids die if you can prevent it.
No, I think that's so obvious as to not even be interesting. I mean,
Wait a second. But then those are first principles that everyone agrees on.
You didn't need the Enlightenment to produce that, right? The argument here is the Enlightenment and using our critical faculties changed things. We were finally able to make moral and political progress. I think from time immemorial, people have understood that, you know, young children dying is a bad thing, and what we should do is try and keep them alive for as long as possible.
Well, but there was, I mean, we did have things like, you know, slavery and human sacrifice and genocide of other peoples. And we had praying to avert famine as opposed to developing vigorous hybrids and artificial fertilizers and crop rotation. So the means to attain those differed as well. But even the idea of universal human flourishing, that isn't so obvious. You go back into a lot of religious codes, and the idea that every last member of Homo sapiens ought to flourish, you know, isn't there.
If we find a lot of these concepts problematic, are there any sort of really viable alternatives, or actually are we kind of stuck with trying to make, you know, the sort of Enlightenment values as we've been talking about them very broadly? Are we stuck with trying to make them work, or are there other alternatives?
The first Enlightenment value is unfettered reason. Unfettered reason is put up on a pedestal. I believe that unfettered reason should be put up on a pedestal. And I would think that all three of us as academics would agree with that. I think the dispute between me and Steve has more to do with what unfettered reason leads to when it comes to important moral and political questions. But I'm in favor of that. Second sort of principal value of the Enlightenment is the focus on the individual. And I do like individualism. And again, as academics, individualism really matters, as we all know. So I'm not against individualism. But my basic point, as I've emphasized here, is that we are all social animals and that we have to carve out space for our individualism. The fact that you, Sophie, live in Britain and Steve and I live in the United States has an influence on how we think about the world. And in my opinion, that makes it more difficult to reach some sort of consensus, to reach some sort of truth on important political and social values. So I'm of a mixed mind about the individualism. I do like individualism, but you have to understand that, again, we're social animals first and foremost. And then with regard to IR, which was my third point before, I think that we live in a fundamentally competitive world. States compete with each other in nasty ways often, and sometimes they even fight wars. That situation has not changed since the beginning of time, and it's not going to change in the future. And I don't think we've made any progress there, although Steve has a particular argument that I haven't addressed, which I'll leave aside for the moment.
Well, the more you try to formulate alternatives to Enlightenment ideals, the better they look, because what are the alternatives? If you start to argue against reason, well, why should we take that seriously if it's either it's reasonable, in which case you signed on to reason, or it's not reasonable, in which case there's no reason to go along with them. You know, likewise, if you're really against individualism, are you okay with your parents arranging a marriage for you? Are you okay with being forced to go to church every Sunday? Are you okay with being forced to do anything for the coherence of the group, not expressing your opinion because it might sow disagreement and dissent, and that would be, you know, uncomfortable? It's very hard to argue for an alternative to individualism, as long as individualism includes the people's preference to belong to various social collectives. International relations, probably we should have a whole other discussion of that, because I do think things have changed, but that's maybe John and I will agree to disagree on that. I would distinguish the normative issue of what ought we to persuade one another of, to argue for, to advocate, from the kind of triumphalist argument that we've won. Everyone agrees with me. No, everyone doesn't agree with me. You know, I think they ought to. I don't think we'll ever reach the point where everyone will. And I wouldn't want to, you know, have the dictatorial power to force people to. But I do think the trend has been in that direction, as it happens. Now, those are separate. It could be there are ideals that would be good if more and more people adopt, and they're immune to reason and they do the wrong thing. Those are two separate arguments, but I would argue the Enlightenment ideals, A, are what we ought to strive for, and B, they haven't triumphed, but that's the direction that that we've been going.
I think, Steve, that there is a large element of triumphalism in your book. And in fact, when I read it carefully, I couldn't help but think about Frank Fukuyama's very famous article, The End of History, which was published in 1989, because Frank's argument is that we're making progress, that in fact, we defeated fascism in the first half of the 20th century, communism in the second half of the 20th century, and the future is liberalism. In other words, liberal democracies like the United States have the wind at our back. And what we're going to get over time is more and more liberal democracy. And this is progress. And once you have this kind of progress, you don't have fundamental disagreement on moral and political issues. And in fact, given that the country, that all the countries of the world will be liberal democracies, there's not going to be much political disagreement out there. And you remember Frank's big argument at the end of his famous article was that the biggest problem we would face going forward was boredom. And the reason we would face boredom is there would be no more politics, right? There would be no more fights. My argument is because of the limits of reason, the limits of unfettered reason, what you get are really big fights where people are willing to kill each other. And that's what makes politics, to use Barack Obama and Bill Clinton's phrase, a contact sport. And once politics, which is a contact sport, is at play, right, you're not going to make a lot of progress. And in fact, you're going to need a state to keep everybody under control.
Yes, and of course, the end of history was deliberately ambiguous in the two ways that I mentioned. Between that is, you could read it as the goal, the direction that political systems are aiming at or ought to aim at, and the factual claim that in fact we've got there. That history, in terms of say great conflicts, has ended. I read him as arguing more for the former than the latter. And of course, he wrote it before the Berlin Wall fell, before the Cold War ended. If you're just going to tally up the number of liberal democracies, he had a point in that they certainly increased subsequent to writing it. Now, that process has stalled, has even gone a bit backwards. And you know, maybe you and I could have a friendly bet over whether we won't be alive in 25 years to settle the bet, but whether there'll be more liberal democracies or more autocracies.
Well, and on that note, Steve, John, thank you. That was absolutely fantastic. I'm sure everyone watching will join me to thank you very much for such an interesting discussion.
Well, that was an interesting talk.
It definitely was. Now, thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to leave a like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.